When Trust Business Lunch with Elise Glink, the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. Hi, Elise. Welcome back.
Hey, John. Nice to be here.
Lots of numbers in your report today. You know, another one that jumped out at me, what percentage of boomers own their home? If you're in a home, what percentage of boomers have no mortgage? Do you know the number I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's interesting, John. So this is a Redfin survey, and according to the new Redfin survey, more than three quarters of baby boomers are planning to stay in their current home as they age. And the reason that boomers are planning to stay there is because they're financially incentivized to stay. More than half of boomers own a home with no mortgage. And is that the number that you're referring to?
Yeah. I mean, I don't own my home. 54% of baby boomers don't have a mortgage payment. Well, they're not going to sell and jump into a 7% note. No way.
No, they're not going to. And the ones that do have a mortgage, almost all of them have a much lower interest rate, right? These are people who bought their homes 4, 5, 6, 10 years ago.
Or their 3 years ago, 4 years ago when it was 3%.
Correct. And so you've got a 2.5% or 3% or even 3.5% loan. You're not going to trade that out because you're going to have to buy something more expensive, get a bigger loan at twice the price. There's no financial incentive here.
I guess that says something about rates. It also says something about inventory. I mean, I think people are almost acclimated to the notion of having to pay 6 or 7% for the money to buy their house, maybe even a little more. But if the homes are too expensive or they're just not there, then it's beside the point, right? Like the boomers won't move. They're not going to get out of that no mortgage or low mortgage. But that still doesn't change the fact that there isn't any inventory if you want it. So that's the problem.
Yeah, the problem is that if boomers aren't selling, and, you know, it goes to something, I think I want to say something here about generational bubbles, John, if you'll indulge me for a moment. So one of the things that I've been thinking about, when we had the boomers, everybody said, wow, this is a bubble. It's the biggest generation we've seen so far. It was at its height around 78 million people. And then we had Gen X, which was a smaller group. That came through. And then all of a sudden, there were millennials, even bigger, a bigger bubble, baby bubble, call it, than the baby boomers. And now we've got Gen X, which is a little bit smaller. So you've got these large groups of people in concentrated ages coming through, and it definitely manipulates the system. So now we've got the baby boomers. They're turning 65 years old at a rate of something like 4 million people, I don't know, a week, a month, a day, I don't know, a lot of people. And they are sticking in their places where they are because they're still working. The pandemic kind of reinforced the notion that they don't actually want to go smaller when they retire. They might want to have a place for their kids to come back to. And remember, we've got a huge number of young adults living at home with their baby boomer parents who are financially supporting them. And so they're looking, if they went and moved to a different place, John, all those people would be looking for more money in their budget because they're not going to give up supporting their kids. So it's kind of an interesting system right now.
Before we go to that job survey, anything else you want to say about homes, home prices, baby boomers sitting on them, stuff like that?
They're just, it's interesting, John. I think we should all just expect that price points are going to continue to go up. And there are certain states like California and Texas that also financially incentivize people to stay in their homes because they lock in their property tax rates and the amount that they pay. And so as they get older, they're 65, 70, and they've got fixed incomes, they don't get priced out because property taxes get higher. And we do have some of that here in the United in Illinois as well. But California and Texas, I think, do a little bit better job with that.
They lock in the property tax rate? It doesn't go up?
Yeah, it's interesting. You end up at a certain, whatever you're paying in taxes, it stops. Or it just goes up minutely after that. And if you sell and buy something else in California, you can take your current property tax rate that you're paying and apply it to the new house.
I've never heard of such a thing. We have some version of that in Illinois?
We don't have a version of that, but we do have discounts for seniors and the ability
Veterans. Okay. Talk to me about that job report, the Q1.
Yeah, so SoFi, which does a whole different kinds of lending, and they work with a lot of employers. So every quarter, they do a future of work survey. And the numbers around financial stress were really astonishing this time. 86% of employees are stressed about their money right now. It's a huge number. It's bigger than it's ever been. 60% of those are worried about inflation. And the majority of people say they're barely able to make ends meet, so they're feeling much more insecure about their financial future. And interestingly, people, they look at the confidence that you have of of managing your money. 40% of Gen Z feels confident, or that the way that they're managing their money is really excellent, right? That they feel confident in it. Just a little over 10% of baby boomers and just slightly more than Gen X are feeling the same way. So the people who are most confident about their money, Gen Z, even though they have the least amount of it.
Now they also have more time in front of them than baby boomers.
They do. And, you know, but 2/3 of people overall are unprepared to handle an expense like facing a car repair or they've got a broken appliance. That's up from just 14% a year ago, right? So 66% are unprepared to handle a major unexpected expense. That's up 14% from 2023. And 40% are stressed about not having enough money for a major purchase, like a car or a wedding. And then a huge number are also feeling very worried about student loan debt.
What do you mean about that?
Well, so 78% of employees are currently paying down student loans right now. I mean, that's just an astonishing number. Astonishing number. And in general, you know, employers are trying to reach employees right around the student loan thing. So a few years ago, the IRS issued a letter that said that employers could make a tax-deductible tax-deductible payment towards an employee's student loans as long as they made it directly. And right now, employers can make, if they contribute to a 401k, it's tax-deductible. So they wanted the same treatment for helping employees pay down their student loan debt. And that letter got issued, I don't know, it's now 4 or 5 years ago, maybe even more. But still, more employees come into the workforce and they've got a huge amount, ever bigger amount of student loan debt. And so this is a really big problem for employers because people just are all focused on overall debt, but of course student loan debt.
I'm trying to remember where it was, but I only recently discovered that phenomenon at all, that some employers have programs where they pay down your student debt. Maybe not all of it, but the program I heard was like, if you come to work for us, we'll pay every month $100 towards your student debt. And for every year you're with us, we'll increase that by $50 a month up to a certain point. But if your employer is paying few hundred dollars towards your student loan, that's huge. And it makes you less inclined to job hop, right? Like you'll stay with that employer if he's going to pay your student loan. I think that's a really smart idea.
Yeah, I think that more employers are getting the hang of that. And certainly the research bears that out, where employees say they would be more likely to stay with their employer over the long term if they matched student loan payments with retirement contributions. So they're trying to figure out more ways to do this. And, you know, some employers obviously are going to be better able to do it. They're making more money. A lot of employers are struggling. They're not going to be able to do it. But if you look at sort of overall debt burdens, really student loan debt is a huge problem. And, of course, this is what Biden is trying to get at with, you know, yet another, he's going, you know, again to try to get student loan debt wiped out for as many people as he can.
Yeah, Ray Kaplan sent me a text today. It's another 20 or 200,000 people. It seems like every day you turn around, and here it is, Biden's new student loan forgiveness plan could erase up to $20,000 in interest payments on student loans. And I don't know how this is different than what we've been talking about all along, but it just seems like every day there's another version or application of what the president is trying to do. And I think it's a double-edged sword. I think everybody loves it who gets it, but even a lot of the people that get it question the wisdom of it. Should we be forgiving student debt? You incurred a debt, maybe more than you should have, but it's your debt. So don't you have an obligation to pay it? Everybody will take it, but not everybody agrees that it's good policy.
Well, I think what's interesting about what he's trying here is he's not really forgiving the debt. He's getting rid of the interest rate.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. And I did just say that, didn't I? And I think there's a lot of support for that, don't you?
I do. Absolutely.
Okay, that's it. Elise Glink at Think Link Media. Always a pleasure, Elise. Thanks for your help today.
You're welcome, John.
Eclipse shadow at 1,500 miles an hour makes its way across the USA and into Carbondale and then Indianapolis. And a lot of you are there, heading there. You can feel free to text the road conditions or any other points of interest along the way for our listeners, 312-981-7200. Let's talk to Jim Dahlke now. He regularly joins us on Monday, too. Jim, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
Hey, John, doing great. Thanks for having me.
You're going to head outside and look at the eclipse, are you?
You know, I'm excited for the people that are excited about the eclipse. I'm not sure that I'm all that interested in it, but hey, I'm pumped for the people who are excited about this.
I'm a little bit like that. I think that's a good way to put it. Jim is the national editor at American Inno. The venture capital is down this year, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, those who were hoping for a startup funding rebound in 2024 were out of luck last quarter. The number of venture capital deals in the first quarter fell actually to the lowest level we've seen since 2017, just 2,882 venture deals last quarter. That's down 16% from the previous quarter and about 28% from the same time last year. Total amount raised was also down. Startups raised a little over $36 billion last quarter. That's 8% behind last quarter and 29% off the first quarter of 2023. And so, one thing we're seeing is just in 2024 really is more of the same from what we saw last year. Fewer number of deals, less capital coming in.
And why is that? Is it a lack of funds or a lack of good ideas?
So it's a good question. It's a little bit of a flight to quality. So investors raised the most funding in history in 2022. So, yeah, there was cash available, but what investors have decided to do is to put that into their best performing companies and the best startups that are emerged. And I think what that has resulted in is a lot of companies who could raise funding in 2020, 2021 simply just have not been able to do so because investors are putting their money into the absolute best performing businesses that are both in their portfolio and coming onto the scene. One thing that we actually have seen, though, is fundraising is starting to drop in terms of money that are raised by venture capital firms themselves. So what we've seen is funds raised by VC firms have continued to experience a decline. They raised just $9.3 billion last quarter. That's only 11% of what we saw in all of last year, and already knowing that 2023 was a down year for venture capital funds raising capital overall shows that the investors within those funds are really not interested right now in investing in startups. And so, these limited partners that we call them are putting their capital elsewhere. And so that could create even more difficult, runway ahead here for startups that are continuing to look to raise funding. So, it's not like the money has completely dried up, but boy, are we in a different place than we were in 2021.
It's funny because every day it seems like we're talking about some new tech idea. It's either chips or batteries or AI or so many things that typically venture capital dollars would flow to. Is it that the big guys are getting the money and these smaller startups are not gaining traction?
Well, we've definitely seen an increase in funding for artificial intelligence. That's kind of the one major positive takeaway for the startup and tech community over the last few years is that AI has gone absolutely gangbusters, and those companies are raising a significant amount of money. And I think in some instances, yes, that has pulled attention away from businesses that might be just sort of doing, you know, for lack of a better word, ho-hum software. You know, so I think we're seeing a lot of companies pivot to AI and kind of incorporate artificial intelligence into their business when they can. But clearly, investors are looking first and foremost to get their money into the best performing AI startups that they can.
Talk about Nuclei then.
Yeah, speaking of AI, so this is a Chicago biotech AI firm, Nuclei AI. Really interesting. They just raised $14 million in new funding last week. The big backer in their round is actually Merck's corporate venture capital arm. So the pharmaceutical giant investing here in the Chicago startup. They're what they call a spatial AI biomarker company. Essentially, what they are doing is mapping cellular interactions within your tissue samples and helping predict better therapeutic outcomes. And basically what that means is they are using artificial intelligence to analyze different medical imaging to help tailor personalized medical treatment based on your kind of makeup. So, right, they're able to like use artificial intelligence to kind of create a better treatment plan. So think for cancer, for example, basically able to kind of use medical imaging, AI on top of that, really identify what the specific solution somebody might need for their treatment of cancer. And so $14 million for Nuclei, not a bad round of funding here for a company that's backed by a big pharma company.
And that's a company here in Chicago.
That's correct.
Where are most of these companies? Every week you tell us about more and more of these businesses, which are just fascinating to me. Are they downtown? Are they in the suburbs? Is there a corridor of these kinds of businesses? Where are they?
Yeah, I mean, they're a little bit everywhere. So, you know, the West Loop has certainly been, you know, Fulton Market area has certainly been a hot spot for venture-backed tech businesses over the last, you know, 5-7 years. You know, that area of the city is growing rapidly. You know, we'd seen a lot of clusters, in 1871, that the tech hub in the Merchandise Mart was really kind of a catalyst for lots of tech operations to open up shop kind of within 1871 space, but also the Merchandise Mart overall. And then, you know, the Groupon building, you know, that hub kind of in that area was a big cluster of startups launched by the Groupon folks and others. And so, you know, it's a little bit everywhere, but we've certainly seen quite a bit of momentum in the Fulton Market space.
So, but isn't Chicago experiencing, or isn't it forecast that we will see a bit of a bounce back in tech and AI? Or, well, maybe not AI, but tech anyway?
Yeah, you know, a new report just came out that took a look at, you know, kind of what we expect for tech jobs in Chicago. And we are expected in the city to see a modest increase in tech jobs this year. So a group called CompTIA, which is a nonprofit group that kind of tracks this, they expect that Chicago is going to add about 2,000 tech jobs in 2024, about a 0.9% increase. So might not sound like a lot, but that's coming after 2023. We actually saw a net decline in overall tech jobs. Chicago actually lost 717 tech jobs last year, about a 0.3% decline, according to CompTIA. So, hey, you know, it's obviously good news that, you know, Chicago's on the upswing, but, you know, Chicago's job increase is going to come in only at the 22nd most across the U.S., so the 22nd most major U.S. metro to add more tech jobs in the city. So New York City coming in at number one, adding about 19,000, followed by Dallas with 15,000.
So we're still struggling. It seems like you've also told us the last couple of years about how Chicago is trying to be a bigger player in the tech space. We're still on the fringes, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, I think folks in Chicago would like to see Chicago continue to show up at the top of these lists and the top of these rankings. You know, one thing to note that, you know, tech is just a smaller piece of the overall economy here compared to other metros. I think Chicago's, you know, the tech economy makes up about 5.5% of the overall workforce in Chicago. Compare that to, you know, Washington, where I think it's close to 20. Of course, think Washington home to, you know, companies like Amazon and Microsoft. And so there's certainly just, you know, more tech clusters there compared to Chicago. But, you know, certainly folks in Chicago would like to see the city land higher up on some of these rankings.
Jim Dahlke, national editor at American NO. You can click on ChicagoNO.com for more stories like this. Nice to talk to you today, Jim.
Thanks, John.
More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch. with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A new report says Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson has proposed a deal with the airlines that would keep the O'Hare project on track. Cranes reports the mayor has told the airlines about a plan that would change the order of construction of new terminals that would keep the revitalization project on track without eliminating key pieces of the plan. United and American Airlines want to build the global terminal replacement for Terminal 2 sooner rather than later. The city's proposal was to build two satellite concourses before the global terminal. The airlines recently received a new proposal from the city, but the details of that proposal haven't been disclosed. Plans to build a dining and entertainment complex at Goose Island have been scrapped. Chicago developer R2 had previously announced plans for part of the site, a former boatyard at 934 North Branch. Crane says the property has been sold to a local investment group for nearly $6 million. It's unclear why the development didn't move forward. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
And the business of food, here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And let's see who's on the phone. Are you a farmer?
I have some tomatoes in my backyard.
Okay, so he's not a farmer, but he is kind of famous around Chicago's west and southwestern burbs. And he's trying to help farmers, who he is, after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. You know, we hear all the time how Congress is so divided and can't agree on much of anything. And when it comes to supporting a bill about climate change, odds are it's a Democrat supporting it. If a member of Congress is supporting something that will benefit farmers who tend to vote red, odds are it's a Republican. But here comes a bill that both parties are behind, maybe for different reasons. Democrat Sean Kasten's on the phone. He represents Illinois' 6th District.
No one would confuse this for an agricultural district.
So why is he sponsoring a bill that would benefit people who tend to vote Republican?
We got involved with this trying to figure out what can we do from a climate perspective that can take carbon out of the air in a profitable way.
And what he and Republican Congressman Mike Bost of downstate Illinois want to have included in the farm bill this year is a program that pays farmers to plant cover crops.
Yeah, so the idea is this would reduce your crop insurance payments. If you put an acre in cover crops, your crop insurance payments will fall by $5 an acre.
He says similar programs at the state level in Illinois and Iowa have proven that farmers win, soil quality wins, the climate wins, and so does the crop insurance program.
Just a 1% increase in cover cropping has led to a 40% reduction in crop insurance payments. And oh, by the way, it's also good for the climate because those cover crops pull CO2 out of the air.
Kasten is asking the head of the House Ag Committee to include his bill in the farm bill,
which is historically, it has been a bipartisan bill. It's a little hard to tell right now.
Yeah, most of the money in the farm bill does not go to farms. It goes to SNAP and other food programs.
And that tends to be more partisan. I don't know how to handicap our progress on a farm bill this year, but I think anything we're going to do on this particular cover program is going to need to be part of the farm bill, not as a separate standalone bill.
Congressman Sean Kasten, not a farmer, but he's trying to help them and the climate. From the farm to your belly, today's National Empanada Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Tasha Moss joins us now, the manager at Aurora Financial Empowerment Center. In Aurora, a financial empowerment center. They got an event coming up. Tasha, thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm here. Hi, I'm sorry I was on mute. It's not to disturb you guys. I'm doing well.
Yeah, good to hear your voice. So tell me about the Financial Empowerment Center. That's a place in Aurora, right?
Yes, we're located in the city of Aurora, Illinois. We provide free one-on-one financial counseling to Aurora residents and our surrounding community. The Neighbor Project is our service provider, and they deliver our counseling services. We serve individuals who are at least 18 years of age or older. They're employed, and they're committed to achieving their financial goals in the areas of increasing and improving their credit scores, lowering and eliminating debt, starting and increasing their savings, and establishing and maximizing bank accounts.
Hmm. Do other towns do that? I don't know the Joliet or Bolingbrook or Chicago version of that. It's interesting that Aurora has that.
Yes, we are the first and still the only FEC in the state of Illinois.
And how are you financed? Is it from the city, or how does this happen?
Well, we started with a grant from the cities from financial empowerment. And the city for financial empowerment, they also partner with Bloomberg Philanthropies. And it's a national non-for-profit that supports municipal efforts to help low-income families and individuals achieve long-term financial stability. And they do that by helping us embed financial empowerment strategies into local government. So we started with a grant.
And is it for then middle or low-income people? What's the threshold I have to, I guess, be under to use your services?
Well, that's the good thing, John. While we target low to moderate income individuals, there is no income threshold for our services.
That's good to hear, because I think sometimes people with a lot more money also have bigger money problems sometimes, right?
Yes, yes, that's true. And we also want to contribute to community development. We're very aware of the social impact of sustainable financial literacy, that when we have strong people and strong families, we then in turn create strong communities. And then we have a strong city and a strong state. And then we're able to impact. So we're also interested in community development. And we do realize that when we address financial literacy and improve stability at the community level, it contributes to the overall stability of our financial ecosystem.
Amen to that. So you have an event. This is Financial Literacy Month. You have an event coming up on the 26th. Just tell us briefly about that.
Sure. Our open house is scheduled for April 26th at 8:30 a.m. We're inviting out all of our non-for-profit partners, our community partners as well. We'll be highlighting our progress at the FEC thus far. We've made some great strides since implementing in 2020, so we want to highlight that progress. We also want to shine a spotlight on our integrations. We have three different types of integrations that our non-for-profits and community programs can integrate with us. We'd also like to highlight how those integrations enhance the outcomes of referred clients.
So do I sign up in advance, or can I just show up that day?
Please do sign up in advance. On our website, www.cityofaurorafec.org, there's a QR code that you can scan, or you can reach us at 630-256-4550, and we'll gladly put you on the registration list.
Or click on the City of Aurora site. What a great idea. Tasha Moss, manager of the Aurora Financial Empowerment Center. Tasha, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, John.